Hallo und herzlich willkommen auf dem 38. Dokumentarfilmfestival in München, heute aus dem Silbersaal im Deutschen Theater. Wir sprechen heute über den Film Be Water, Voices from Hong Kong. Der Film hat bei uns seine Weltpremiere und läuft im internationalen Wettbewerb. Hello and welcome to the 38th edition of the Munich Documentary Film Festival. My name is Eva Weinmann and I'm part of the program selection team. Today we are going to talk about the film Be Water, Voices from Hong Kong by director Lia Erbal. The film had its international premiere here and we already had the chance to have a Q&A with the producers, Gunther Hanfgarn and Andrea Ufer, and the editor Udo Bremmer. Today we have two new guests and this time we have the chance to dive a little bit deeper into the political aspect surrounding the topic. So let me introduce today's guests, Nathan Law and Thorsten Benner. Nathan Law is a political activist and politician from Hong Kong. He was one of the student leaders during the 79-day-long umbrella movement in 2014. In 2016, he was elected to serve as legislator for Hong Kong Island. And following the enactment of the National Security Law in July 2020, he had to leave Hong Kong and applied for political asylum in the UK. Thorsten Benner is a political scientist and one of the founders and the director of the non-profit think tank Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin. And we can read his political statements and his insights in publications such as The Times, The Financial Times, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and the Süddeutsche Zeitung, just to name a few of them. Welcome. Nice that you are here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. I didn't know if all of our viewers have seen the film. Sometimes they just watch the talk and watch the film afterwards. So to bring everyone on board, Nathan, can you please very shortly summarize why the 2014 protests happened?
Well, the 2014 protest was taking place because Beijing promised Hong Kong people democracy and autonomy when Hong Kong was handed back from the British government to the Chinese government. And we expected that coming. But in 2014, which was around 17 years after the hangover, we still didn't get our democracy as promised. So Hong Kong people marched down to the street in 2014, but of course we didn't succeed. So as you can see in 2019, a much more powerful, much more massive movement has started, and it was the turning point of Hong Kong.
We will talk about that. But first of all, I want to know what happened, because you got elected, but then you had to went to jail shortly after. Yeah. Can you?
Yeah, so yeah, in 2014, I was the student leader. We had this massive occupation, and it was actually the very first time that we had the massive disobedience in Hong Kong's history. Like, we used to have like 100 people, 200 people blocking down the roads, but we were talking about hundreds of thousands of them in 2014, and that was massive. That was the first time of Hong Kong's history that we understood the idea of civil disobedience. And after that, the civil society had some energy in it. We wanted to be part of the legislature to continue to have a voice and have a platform. So in 2016, I ran for legislature, and by then there were still around half of the seats that were through direct election. The other half of it, they were reserved for Beijing. So no matter how many seats that we have in direct election, we are always minority in the legislature. But nonetheless, because I represent some kind of the umbrella movement spirit and the idea of that, we are entering an age of civil disobedience. So people supported me and I was elected as the youngest legislator at the age of 23. But after all, Beijing still has so much control in Hong Kong, including our judicial system. So when I took the oath, I quoted Gandhi. I said that I will serve my people and I will not serve the regime that kills its people. So those are the things that Beijing says, that you are not pleading allegiance to the country and they kick you out from the council. So I served 9 months. In that period of time, I was voted as top 10 legislators on multiple occasions. I got a lot of support and popularity, but still Beijing, they decided to basically kick me out of the council.
In 2019, the protests started again because of a bill connected to a high-profile murder case connecting Hong Kong and Taiwan. And at this time, China again came into play. Can you explain what the Hong Kongers feared regarding to this bill? So how would the situation have changed?
So by the time of 2019, we have to remember that Hong Kong was still not a democracy. We didn't elect our city's leader. We didn't have a legislature that were direct elected. So at that time, when Beijing wanted to introduce an extradition law to Hong Kong, we were so nervous because we know that the chief executive, which is the leader of the city, that we didn't elect them so that they would not act on behalf of the interest of Hong Kong people. So no matter Xi Jinping saying that, oh, we want Nathan Law, we want Jimmy Lai, we want Joshua Wong, we want all the political activists to be extradited back to China, we knew that the chief executive would not say no. So that was the background of it. Hong Kong people were so nervous. So we marched down to the street. But eventually, because of so much police brutalities and the government's attitude, it evolved from an anti-tradition campaign to a much more massive democracy fighting campaign, that our chief demands turned from shelving the extradition bill to having a full democracy and autonomy. So that was a really, really massive protest movement that a lot of scenes were surreal. We didn't really expect that. A million people, 2 million people that would march down to the streets of Hong Kong, which is a city with 7.5 million populations. And that was extremely massive.
Thorsten, I have a question for you. During this time, what was Germany's stance?
I mean, we watched with concern, as our politicians often said. And of course, Germany in many ways is in a bind because economically we have very close relations with Beijing. We're quite dependent on the Chinese economy. We want to have, like, the government under the leadership then of Chancellor Merkel did want good relations with Beijing. Chancellor Merkel, even under the regime of Chairman Xi Jinping, said we need to stick to this comprehensive strategic partnership and even deepen it. One of the last things Chancellor Merkel did was to push through a comprehensive agreement on investment with China that was after the massive crackdown on Hong Kong. But of course, our foreign minister at the time, he did express concern. He did also, much to the chagrin of the Chinese party state, meet some of the protest leaders in Berlin, but Germany didn't do all that much at the time, as did the rest of Europe, as the movie also shows. The chief European figurehead of foreign policy is Josep Borrell, being quite cordial with the Chinese foreign minister during the protest movement or shortly afterwards. So we didn't do all that much in terms of beyond expressing a lot of concerns. We suspended a bit of, you know, some European countries suspended the extradition treaties with China to the degree they had those, but we didn't take any measures that would have really gone beyond expressing displeasure with these horrific events against all these extremely courageous individuals in Hong Kong. And I think the movie is great in that it gives a sense that this was really a lot of courageous individuals, such as Nathan, but also many others who are not known to the broader world public, who, you know, literally risked their lives to defend an idea or a promise that they had been given, that they would have autonomy in Hong Kong, and that was taken away with utter brutality by the Chinese party state.
Yeah, and indeed, the events have been horrific. People really, they really had a lot of how do I express it? In the film, we see a massive crackdown on the protesters. We see a lot of police brutality. I don't know if we even have the real numbers. I did a quick Google search before, and it says 9,000 protesters have been arrested by July 2020. That's a massive number, but I can imagine that the number in reality is even higher, and also people have been injured, people actually have died and disappeared. How many people? Do we know any numbers?
Yeah, it's difficult to have a clear indication of how many people were injured or even passed away in the protest. When we talk about like the arrest figure, because like we can collect the information that are available to the public, is around 20,000 arrests made. And for now, currently serving jail, there's more than 1,000 people currently serving jail. So political prisoners are still very, it's still a big issue in Hong Kong because these are lingering effects. For the people who were injured, as you could imagine, in the time of the protest, all the major hospitals were being monitored. So when people injured, they were not able to go to the hospital because there were police stationing there. And when they saw people dressing like a protesters or suffering injury, like being hit by rubber bullets, they would ask, where did you go? And if a protester go to those hospital when they were injured, it was like sending themselves to the hands of the police. So people were terrified. And there were a lot of underground network that are voluntary doctors that they will provide necessary medical care to them. So, and that's the reason why we have no idea how many of them, because all these information are very sensitive and there is no estimation of it. But at the end of the day, we saw a lot of attacks on the people when the violence was building up through the process. There were more and more injuries. And yeah, it's difficult to produce a figure on that.
And the pictures and the videos actually went around the world. I remember it well. It was like all over social media. So we could really follow, but at the same time, not really grasp what's going on.
Yeah.
I wonder if Germany or the European Union could have done anything. Should there have anything been done at this point when we really saw what's going on and when we saw the brutality?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is how we can demonstrate the idea that we treasure human rights, we treasure our values with action. So we've seen a lot of statements made. But at the end of the day, we saw French president went to China to do a publicity event with Xi Jinping and praise them. And what we saw is, well, some of the European countries are also trying to normalize their relationship with China when China is still very aggressive, still trying to bully the world. And when Hong Kong's situation has not even getting better, it's getting worse. But we try to pretend nothing has happened. We went there, we said that, oh, we care about human rights, but we will increase our trade with China. We will maintain our good relationship. I think that is difficult to swallow as a human rights activist from Hong Kong. And I think, yes, countries, European Union and China, they need to have certain kind of relationship, but that should be based on, we enhanced when the human rights situation in Hong Kong, China enhanced. We don't try to make it better, but when things in China and in Hong Kong are getting worse, I think it was just sending a signal to Xi Jinping and to Hong Kong government saying that, look, like, we don't care about your human rights violations. No matter how worse is it, we will still try to earn your money and do business with you. I think that is not how we should prioritize our values. So definitely, we want more concrete actions from the European Union. Of course, for now, there are lots of voice, a lot of Baltic countries, especially, they're really, really tough on China, which is really grateful to see, but we need more unity and we need more coherence across the continent.
Thorsten, can you add something from your experience and from your political insights?
I think Nathan is very right. Beijing didn't pay a price for the massive violations of human rights that were committed in this crackdown on Hong Kong. And Nathan is also right that I think most of the European public has almost forgotten about Hong Kong. That's being seen as a fair, complete, you know, water under the bridge. We cannot do anything about this anymore. Beijing has swallowed Hong Kong, and the Hong Kong we knew is gone. And but I think on the positive side, while we, you know, Europe failed to impose any meaningful costs or condition its trade and economic engagement with China on progress or reversing some of the crackdown on Hong Kong, Europe didn't even try to do that. But I do think what Nathan alluded to, that there is a debate in Europe on a more realistic approach to Xi Jinping's China, to which I think the crackdown on Hong Kong has contributed, among other things. The revelations on how Beijing is treating its minorities in Xinjiang and beyond Hong Kong, the aggression vis-a-vis its neighbors in the South China Sea, the threats against Taiwan, the aggressive behavior against some European countries such as Lithuania that dare to change the name of the representation of Taiwan in Lithuania. All that has added to a sense we're dealing with a partner where we need to be cautious we need to de-risk, which seems to be the lowest common denominator in the discussion right now. You know, this is not anything like the courageous behavior that we've seen from those Hong Kongers, you know, who've been trampled on by the Chinese party state. But there's some political entrepreneurs who are quite courageous within Europe. And the film portrays one of them, Reinhard Bütikofer, who has been a true champion of a more realistic approach toward the Chinese party state. And he's also a very credible champion because he spent his youth as a Maoist and he befriended some of those who became very senior figures in the Chinese party state soon after the opening up of China in the mid-70s. So Reinhard Bütikofer is a very credible voice because his approach is China has changed very much. And so our approach to China also has to change. And at least rhetorically, that's exactly the line that German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has embraced to say, you know, China is changing. Our approach has to change, but how far we need to go with changing our approach, that's, of course, up to discussion and debate. And, of course, there's a trade-off between our currently existing dependencies, the profits our companies can make on the Chinese market. And I think if anything, the behavior, like the changes in the approach to China are not necessarily primarily driven by human rights concerns, but they're driven by threats to our core interest in terms of creating dependencies and then being subject to blackmail by the Chinese party state, because the Chinese leadership has made its goal very clear. It itself wants to selectively decouple from the rest of the world and become less dependent on the rest of the world, but it does want to make the rest of the world more dependent on Chinese goods to use that as leverage if it sees other countries as going against the core interests of Beijing. And I think the experience with Russia has been quite helpful, especially in the German debate, because we bet on a rational leader in the Kremlin, and we saw that that bet on rational behavior by authoritarian leaders proved to be a very futile bet. And I think many in the German debate are saying we shouldn't make the same mistake twice by assuming that the Chinese leadership will behave in ways that are rational from our vantage point. And I think while we've forgotten about Hong Kong, unfortunately, in the broader public, pretty much, I do think Taiwan is playing an increasing role in our debate, because we really have to avoid that Beijing moves by force against Taiwan, because these 23 millions, they courageously have built their own democracy, and they don't want to be ruled by Beijing. And I think Taiwanese people have also taken the lesson that a promise by the Chinese party state to have one country, two system is worth exactly nothing. So the only way now is to deter Beijing from taking military action or use force or coercion against Taiwan, which would risk setting off a major war involving the U.S. that the consequences of which would be felt across the globe. And I think that is, and I think with reason, with good reason, is the focus of much of our China debate these days.
I wonder if the city of Hong Kong today still has the same importance to China as it had before the pandemic, or has like the whole focus point maybe more shifted to a city like Shenzhen, with like a mega port. And I think that Hong Kong during the pandemic and during the lockdown maybe might have lost its economic significance a little.
Well, yeah, if we compare to 1997, the significance of Hong Kong's economically to China has definitely dropped. The proportion of this GDP that we contribute to the country, I think we've massively dropped from around 15 to 17% to just a few percentage. So definitely there's a big drop. And that's the reason why the Hong Kong issue is so embedded to the discussion of China, because we also understand that if China maintains the totalitarian model, if they're still very confident in the way that they govern the country, for example, doing massive surveillance to its all population, persecuting Uyghurs, Tibetans, Hong Kongers, depriving ordinary Chinese citizens their freedom of speech and political rights. If they are still very confident in the way that they govern the country, it is really difficult for Hong Kong to get its freedom back, because China could just say that we don't have to have Hong Kong as a way of showing that we want democracy, we want freedom as the rest of the world. Hong Kong used to maintain a certain degree of freedom was because Beijing tries to convince the world that they are a good player in the international stage. They are trying to learn from Hong Kong, from its civilized system and freedom that it gave to Hong Kong people. But today's world, Beijing doesn't think like that anymore. They would just think that we have to impose our dictatorship to the world, and we don't need Hong Kong as an example on those things. So definitely, for now, it's difficult for Hong Kong people to imagine if China stays in this way and then they could get freedom. So I think for me as a activist, as advocate, I also need to ask for larger accountability for China and possibly encouraging Chinese people to have a change inside the country so that we can all enjoy our freedom.
One more question. I want to know about the media in Hong Kong. Is there still free press? I mean, there is the South China Morning Post and there is the Hong Kong Free Press, but are they still able to function like they did before?
The clear answer is no. If we have seen the recent year's reports on the media freedom in Hong Kong, I think it's around 140 out of 180 countries. We have been fallen under some of more underprivileged, impoverished countries, which supposedly we have better system, but actually we don't. So for now, we can see multiple free media were disbanded at the request of the government. For example, the Apple Daily, Citizen News, etc. All these are really, really popular news outlets that report honestly and try to hold the government accountable. All the media left now are the media outlets that Beijing believes that they can control. For example, they get some of the senior executive of this media to be swapped to their own people. They bought those media like Jack Ma bought South China Morning Post and several other newspapers. For now, it's really, really difficult to find a newspaper that is critical to the government because they believe media is the fourth estate, because they believe media has a responsibility to hold the government accountable. Sometimes, for now, media criticize the government because it doesn't upset China. They could just criticize minor things. That's what we call you speak on minor things to help the government to create a facade of diversity of opinion. But for now, it's definitely no media freedom, no press freedom. Honest reporters are being targeted, are being prosecuted. And that is the reality of Hong Kong.
Do you still have hope for Hong Kong? Do you still have hope for change? Or maybe let's phrase it a little bit differently. What are your hopes now, if you look at the current state of the world and Hong Kong? And of course, we cannot really leave Taiwan out of the whole discussion as well. So what do you wish for the city?
Well, the current state of Hong Kong is definitely depressing. We don't see any political activities at all. The government doesn't approve any rallies, demonstrations. People are being tightly monitored. Many people have to report to the National Security Police on a regular basis to be monitored, to talk with them. I think it's really difficult for Hong Kong people to see a way out in short-term future, let's say 3 to 5 years. But as I said, I don't believe China can maintain its model forever. There will be a lot of legitimacy crisis that they will encounter when they are economically not performing, struggling on industrial upgrades, aging society, so that there are a lot of problems in their society. There are a lot of risks and challenges laying ahead. And Xi Jinping also tries to say that the only possible route for him to become the greatest leader in China in history, one of the requirements is getting Taiwan back, the so-called reunification. So there is also potential threats that they will launch military aggression, no matter it's in the upcoming 5 years or in the upcoming 15 years. I don't think any of us can have an exact timeline of where it will happen. But it will happen as long as Xi Jinping still has that ambition and has that narrative of the rejuvenation of the great nation and the 100 years of humiliation. They see getting Taiwan as part of the PRC as one of the most important tasks of their regime. So that is definitely a very volatile, dangerous situation. And that's the reason why we all have to support Taiwan. Democracies have to support Taiwan. We have to be united.
Thorsten, you already talked about the situation, and you already talked about Hong Kong and about the threat that Taiwan has to face and what it means for the world. But can you maybe summarize the situation again for our viewers? Like, what is your outlook? Where do you think is this heading?
I think the history is wide open. So there's no foregone conclusion. And I think those, especially on either arguing that the Chinese Communist Party will be in power forever, and I think they're making the same mistake as Germans made after 1989. We thought history was over and it's all moving in the direction of democracy. But I think the reverse is also wrong, to assume that an authoritarian regime is inherently stable and that the Chinese Communist Party will last forever, rule forever in the same way that Xi Jinping wants it to rule, and achieve this dream of taking control of Taiwan, an island that the Communist Party state has never controlled throughout its existence. That's not necessarily a foregone conclusion. History is wide open, also on Taiwan. Those who argue it's set in stone that Beijing will attack Taiwan are also making, I think, arguments that are not necessarily on solid foundations, because we have it in our power, at least to, on the one hand, first of all, Taiwanese have it in their power to prepare for such an attack. They're the most important, who we need to listen to, and we need to do everything we can support them within reason. I don't think we should encourage independence movement of Taiwan, but we should do everything that help the Taiwanese people to defend the peaceful status quo. And we need to do what one of the senior leaders, we need to contribute as Europeans to deterrence. And what does deterrence mean? One of the senior leaders of the U.S. Pentagon, Colin Carr, recently said, no, he wants Xi Jinping to wake up every day and say, oh, it would be so great if I achieved my rhetorical mission and took control of Taiwan, but to say today is not the day, because the cost of that is too high. And I think it will be tough to affect that calculus, because as we've seen with Putin, authoritarian leaders have their own rationality. They're motivated by power and the ideology, and Xi Jinping certainly is. But I think we need to do our best on the military front. That's not Europe's job, but that's the job of the Taiwanese people and the U.S. and regional allies of Taiwan. But Europe needs to be very, very clear that if China moves aggressively against Taiwan, the reaction will be very different from our reaction to Hong Kong, that we will indeed support the broadest possible economic and technology denial sanctions, and that it will be akin or even stronger to the reaction Europe showed to Putin's aggression of launching an all-out invasion of Ukraine. That's our only hope, that to keep the peace is through deterring Chinese aggression. And Europeans need to be very clear about their contribution to this. And of course, you can only credibly say that you will support economic and technology denial sanctions if you don't have a lot of dependencies on China. Otherwise, Beijing laughs and say, you're so dependent on us, 95% on solar energy, your whole energy transition is dependent on us. So we urgently need to de-risk, reduce our dependencies on China, also to be, not to be able to be blackmailed by Beijing, but also to be credible on the deterrence equation. And for Germans, I think that's a hard lesson to learn, because the world we had where we could just do business with everyone and with China and not think twice about these things, that's very much gone. It was a comfortable world for us, and I think we've learned the hard way with Russia that we placed some very wrong bets. I think we placed some very wrong bets, our political leaders, on China, that China would open up further if we only, traded with it a lot more. And we need to learn our lessons from that, and we need to learn those lessons fast, and that will come with costs. But the cost for us will be nowhere near the cost that Nathan and the many courageous Hong Kongers have paid for them standing up, or that the Taiwanese people would pay if actually Beijing took control of the island. And so we need to put this in perspective, what we need to do in our own interest to reduce these dependencies and stand up for deterring Chinese aggression. That, we'll pay a price for that. It was a very small price, also very small compared to the price of having a war over Taiwan that would alter the course of the history of this century.
Thank you very much. We have to come to an end now. Nathan, I want to give you the chance. Is there anything you want to say to the audience? Like, use this platform.
Well, thank you so much for coming to watch the film. I think it's been a few years since the Pumi film started, and there are many, many good films that have documented what we've been through and what the world should do. I really do hope that Hong Kong is not only a place that you kind of like heard in news, but for now, as you have seen the film, it is a place that are connected to you and that you have feeling towards it. And that's the only way that this city is not going to lose its significance, even though the news is not talking about it, even though everyone seems to feel like they don't really see any changes in Hong Kong. But that is the only possibility that it matters to you. And when it matters to you, you will try to do something for it, just like the rest of us, we do. So thank you so much for coming. I really do hope that you can continue to pay attention to Hong Kong, and also ask your countries, ask your political representative to pay attention to Hong Kong and to be assertive to Chinese aggression.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for being here today. The film will have two more screenings on Friday the 12th and on Sunday the 14th. And it's also running at the online festival for another 13 days. And it's nominated for the Kino Kino Audience Award, sponsored by Dreisat and PR. And you can vote for it. You can vote online, and you can also vote when you go to the cinema. And thank you all very much. And thank you for the film.